The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the programme. It is 3 minutes past nine on this Monday, the 7th of September 2026. And I hope you had a fantastic weekend, whatever you were doing. And lots of people did lots of stuff. Lots of people just chilled out too. Others worked. Oakfest, I saw some of the imagery coming from it. Lots of people from Highland Radio seem to have a great time there alongside thousands of others from the wider community. Looked fantastic. And I, along with 82-odd thousand other people, were down for Katie Taylor's farewell. And what a show that was. What an atmos. It was absolutely unbelievable. Just a great thing to say. You were a part of, in terms of the audience. That being said, boxing, as I said, in a stadium setting, unless you're pretty close to the ring, you don't see a whole pile. But anyway, you got the walk on, you got the Westlife and all that kind of jazz as well. Right, 1 second here. Yes, my camera has gone all funky on me. And actually, speaking of cameras, we're back on Facebook, by the way. If you normally watched us on Facebook, we're back there live. We're on YouTube. So you can watch on your smart TV, your Fire Stick, across Facebook and on the X platform. Right, anything you want to say that happened to you over the weekend or where you were or anything at all, let us know. 086 60 25000. Let's get to the newspapers now. We'll start with the Dairy People Donegal News. And Donegal's coroner has followed up his criticism of the government and the country's post-mortem system by issuing a series of recommendations. The Donegal News last week reported that Dr. Dennis McCauley, who is the Donegal County Coroner and the incoming president of the Coroner's Society of Ireland, claimed the system is crumbling. The system is overseen by the HSC along with the government departments of health and justice, but Dr. McCauley's claimed they don't understand what's going on. He's now underscored his criticism by telling the paper what he believes needs to happen. And you can read those comments in that paper today. Let's go to the Derry News. And residents were evacuated from their homes following a suspected arson attack on a neighbouring property in Derry. Police are appealing for information about the fire, which was reported at 6:05 a.m. on Saturday at a derelict building in the Greenon Drive area. A PSNI spokesperson said officers attended the scene, where colleagues from the Northern Ireland Fire and Service Rescue were already present extinguishing the fire. There was no one in the building at the time and no injuries were reported. On to the Nationals now, and good news for data centres. Whilst the rest of you are facing increases in electricity and gas prices, data centres are to get cut price gas in return for accepting the possibility of disruption to their supply under a proposal from the energy regulator. The move comes as the regulator, the Commission for Regulation of Utilities, warns data centre expansion will make it hard to source enough gas to meet national demand during extreme cold events. CRU analysis show that 17 planned new data centres would have the gas demand of six large gas-fired electricity generators, or 2.6 million homes. Wow. Under the proposed deal, new data centres would get discounted gas on condition they accept that when gas demand is very high nationally, they may experience planned interruptions. It's an interesting offer that they've made. So we'll give you cheaper gas, and it might be cut off if the rest of the country needs it, or it may not. I don't know, but there you go. That's what they're proposing. No such propositions for the rest of us, though. I'm reading this actually just in case some of you out there qualify for this and are not aware. Tens of thousands of older people are missing out on estate financial support that would help them pay high energy bills. More than 100,000 households with people over the age of 70 who are entitled to the household benefits package may be failing to get it. So listen up, if you've someone in the house or you are that person over 70 and you're not getting some support for your fuel costs. The scheme sees those who qualify receiving €580 a year from the government to help with the cost of energy bills and to pay for a TV licence. People over the age of 70 qualify without needing a means test. One payment is made per household. In some cases, under 70s can qualify if they meet certain conditions. The Department of Social Protection analysis has revealed that as many as 116,000 households with at least one person over 70 are not receiving the payments. That's €580 that could be in your bank account to help with the TV licenses and for fuel. A department of, I read that bit, didn't I? The findings come at a time when cost of living pressures are uppermost in most households. Ireland has the most expensive electricity in Europe, with fears of further rises in the price of electricity, gas and home heating oil, given the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. Right, so double check. You may well be entitled to that payment. €580 if you or someone in the house is over 70. Not means tested, they say. One of the payments is not means tested. And I suppose if there's 116,000 aren't claiming it, probably 10, 15, 20,000 of those are potentially in this county. Well, maybe not that quite high, but you get where I'm coming from. Big political changes in Germany, and I sort of anticipate we'll see this creeping in across Europe. Germany stands on the brink of a political earthquake as a hard-right nationalist party looks set to take control of a regional parliament for the first time since the end of Nazi rule 8 decades ago. Now, just because this might come up in the days ahead or in the weeks and months ahead, and this is a political description of their politics, right? So in this country, calling someone far-right has become something of an insult almost, right? But politically, this party is hard-right, it is far-right. That is not an insult or slander, it's just the way they're described. And they would describe themselves as a hard-right party. So just in case people think I'm reading propaganda, it is not that. This is separate from far right being used as some sort of an insult over here, right? So this party is hard right. Last night, an official exit poll showed that 44.5% of voters in the sprawling eastern state of Saxony-Anhalt backed the xenophobic and anti-immigration party Alternative for Germany. The projected victory set alarm bells ringing in Berlin and Brussels as the AfD has pledged to protect the homeland by deporting all illegal migrant, shutting the border, banning LGBTQ rainbow flags in state schools and halting the construction of new wind farms. And not only that, actually, they're going to try and encourage people who have derived from immigration to leave. Its leader in the state, 35-year-old Ulrich Slegmund, also wants to reform the public broadcasters and compulsory school attendance and rewrite school history books, which focus too much for his liking on the crimes of the Third Reich. Now, I'm not incredibly well-travelled, but I did go to Germany once. And the one thing I did notice about Germany was that it was struggling with dealing with the Third Reich, to deal with its history, and that swathes of its culture and its music that really wasn't connected to Nazi Germany, but had been sort of banned as and there was moves, and I was chatting to locals over there that thought it had gone too far, that they were losing, you know, buildings and culture that actually really had nothing to do with Hitler's Germany. But anyway, that is happening over there. It's not insignificant, and we'll see what happens in the rest of Europe. Unless you're directly affected by this, you may not realise that the courts are at a standstill as lawyers refuse to offer legal aid services amid a furious row over fees. Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan claimed last week that they are still running effectively, but a solicitor taking part in the strike has called this simply nonsense. Solicitor Kate McGee said, "For the minister to be saying that the courts are operating just fine is nothing short of laughable. The fact is, not one can pretend that this is going ahead even half as normal. It is at a standstill." So the reality, a confliction of reality there as much as anything else. And finally, what is next for Katie Taylor? It was a remarkable event, it has to be said. But I know from speaking to her manager when he was up here that he's planning a play that he wants her to be involved with. I was speaking to her and she was talking of, you know, wanting to pay it forward and train and support and promote fighters. But also, too, she could pop on pop up on Netflix or some other streaming service. Because now that Katie Taylor has said goodbye to her boxing career, many fans are wondering what is next for the Bray Woman. Now her longtime manager, Brian Peters, has pulled back the curtain and revealed her future plans may involve a movie adaptation. He hinted that some popular streaming giants are already vying for the rights to her story, and it would be a great film. It would be a great film because, you know, what's interesting about her story is how what she had to do to actually compete in this sport. She obviously, she obviously had to pretend she was a boy so that she could actually even get into a gym in the first place. She had to lobby the IOC to get it as an Olympic sport, whereby she did the and was involved in the demonstration bout to prove it had a place in the Olympics, and she was successful in that. Then she was successful in the Olympics, and then she reached out to a boxing promoter and said, look, I can do something in boxing. She drove all of this herself, and Eddie Hearn took a punt on her, and here we are. So she has driven not only her own career but women's boxing in ways that I think would make for a fantastic, fantastic film. So let's hope that is made. Good morning, Diana.
Good morning, Greg.
We've been talking an awful lot about statistics and studies and all that type of stuff in relation to home ownership. And in fact, the fact that, you know, almost half of people over a certain age don't think they'll ever own a home. You're watching on, like many of us are, on your daughter, Diana. And what's her situation?
Well, they're both working. He's a welder and she's a carer. They have three young children. And they're in a mobile home, two-bed mobile. Mm. They're due twins now in December. They have went down every route to try and get a mortgage, a loan, something, to try and get a house bought, but getting nowhere with it. Basically, they're earning too little to get a decent mortgage, and they're earning too much to apply for a council house. So it's just very hard for them, like, to try and get anything set up.
Yes, because they want to plan for their future, don't they? They want their own place.
Well, that's it. And then they came out with this idea of these, as I would call, a garden shed in the back garden.
Mm.
Sure, like, where do you go with that? Like, that would, you know, that's only maybe for a couple. It's not for anybody with children anyway.
And also, too, I'd imagine they don't want to be. They're trying to save as well, aren't they? You know, in terms of deposit, hence not renting in the open market, I'm guessing.
Well, that's why they didn't go for the rent way, because obviously it drains your money, whatever you're earning, and that's why they have the mobile. But like, it's not viable now for what they need it for, if you know what I mean. And I've been speaking to other young people and with less children, some without children at all, and they can't even see a way around getting a mortgage or a, you know.
And the thing is they're doing everything right, aren't they? If it wasn't for the inflated house prices, they would be in their own home now because, you know, between saving and both working, etc. You know, they can get a decent mortgage. It's just there's no property available for what they can actually borrow.
Yeah. And anything that is available for what they can borrow, say 190,000 or whatever, there's a lot of work in it. It could take you your lifetime to get it up to the standard that you need, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
She even looked into that rent to buy. Texts or emailed the council and stuff, but sure, nobody ever gets back to you. This is what annoys me. You know, she's went to TDs, councillors, they emailed back, surely, or whatever, but never helped any further. It was one email and that was it, and nobody has ever got back about anything. So I just don't know why nobody's out there to try and help these young people to try and get a decent mortgage or a home. Like, they don't know where to start or who to go to, or, you know.
And I think even too, you mentioned the modular home, as you say, that's not a forever home. And I think you can, I mean, you can't really, I don't think you can mortgage them either, as far as I'm aware, and I'm open to correction on that. Maybe
no,
you can, but
You can't mortgage them.
Well, there you go. There's another challenge that kind of half rules that out in a way.
Yeah. And then, like as I say, I know couples there that have actually built extensions onto their parents' home because they just couldn't get a big enough mortgage to buy a house. So they just put an extension onto their parents' home. I know another situation where the parents have given their house to their child before they've passed away even and took out a loan themselves, maybe in their 60s, which was ridiculous, to buy a house for themselves. Mm-hmm. Because obviously they're better set up, you know, than the younger person. But, like, it's just beyond a joke at this stage.
And you watching on too, it's very frustrating, isn't it? You know, it's very frustrating that you see them doing everything right, but they can't get a break.
No, definitely can't get a break. I even have considered putting an extension on my own home. It's just I don't have the room, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
To at least get them some way started. And life, like, and try and, you know, maybe let them see if till they get sorted or whatever. But, like, I don't know. It's just very hard for them.
Yeah, you see, the thing about that too is that moms, dads, granny and granddads, etc., are kind of, that's why all these rules changed. They're kind of being asked a lot, I think, because whilst we want the very best for our children, we don't necessarily want them living in the house forever, or we don't necessarily want them living in the backyard. And it feels,
well, that's true,
you know, because it's. But we're being put in a situation where I think lots of people are doing that, even though they know it's not necessarily what they want to do.
Well, that's it. And like at the end of the day, you try and get them up, and as you say, you want them to go out and live their own lives and enjoy their lives, but like. You know, a lot of people are staying now at home, building on to their mother and parents, you know, their mother and father's homes and maybe even grandparents' homes just to keep afloat, do you know what I mean? And that just makes no sense.
And also, as well as that too, and no, we're not talking about you or me now, Diana, just to be clear. I'm just, because it's just the way the system is being set up. What we're also looking at too is theoretically, I'll use me as an example. If Lee got married or didn't get married and had a couple of kids and then said, oh, can I put a cabin out the back? You know, when I'm sort of thinking, right, this is my time now, it's 24/7 back to having young people in the house, if you know what I mean. It's going to be tough enough to live as we get older with the way the country is, but to also have your kids living with you when they're 45 and their kids as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Have they tried... go ahead, Diana, please.
Sorry.
No,
at the end of the day, this hasn't just started now. This has been going on for years, and people, it hasn't been resolved. It's even myself, like I applied for council housing when I was, I think it was maybe 18 or 19. Mm. I was a very young mum, and sure, I never got a council house up until my daughter was 16. You know what I mean? So, like, my wins was more or less half reared at that stage. So, you know. Yeah.
And also, too, there's an awful lot of people like your family in this middle space, too much for council support and not enough to go their own way. And it's an awful purgatory to be left sitting in.
Yeah. And then they're coming with a decision because, like, my daughter even said to me the last day, she was like, you know, because I said, oh, somebody will probably say on the radio, you know, don't have children and all this crack. And she goes, so when do you have them? Like,
she says,
I wait till I'm 40.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She says, I don't want to be rearing wains in my 40s and an old mother, you know, she wants to be a young mum and loves children and always wanted to be a mother. And that's just...
We shouldn't be putting people in that position. Whereby they're feeling guilty almost for having children. I mean, look at the birth rate in this country. It's through the floor. And it's for these reasons.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. That's the reasons.
Mm.
And again, from she was a young child herself, I always asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? She says, I want to be a mum.
Right.
So, you know, And, like, she is working. She's a carer. She loves her caring job. Like, and she's even considered leaving that to go into the lower bracket to try and get council housing. But, like, you shouldn't have to make that choice.
No, you shouldn't.
You know. So it's just, I don't know, there's just no support or help for these young ones. And I think it's a terrible state for the country to be in, like, at the present time.
Well, this caller says, I was in a similar situation. I earned too much to get a council house and not enough to get a mortgage. I ended up stopping work so I could qualify. It then took me six years on that list to get a house. So that's someone who stopped contributing to society simply to try and get a roof over their head. 6 years.
Yeah.
That's not a good system if people are making that decision, I think, anyway.
Oh, that's a terrible system. And, like, she has considered this.
Mm.
And also, like, I wouldn't even mind, but she really, really loves her job. She loves being out with, you know, caring for people. And she, like, and at the end of the day, there are not a lot of carers out there. It's getting scarce as well. Do you know what I mean? They're looking steady for these people.
Mm-hmm.
And for her to make that choice, I think it's shocking. Like.
Yeah, okay.
So,
right, let's see what will happen in terms of, you know, budgets and all that type of stuff. Has she tried the credit union out of interest? A couple of people suggesting that.
She has tried the credit union, yes, but now, because she's pregnant with the twins, obviously, she had to go off work early, and she's on illness benefits, so you know yourself, when you're on that, you're back to square one again.
Very frustrating, so, very frustrating for her, and for you as well, as a mum as well. Okay. Right, thank you very much indeed. So, stay there if you want to hear. Councillor Michael McClafferty has an input into this conversation. Good morning, Michael.
Okay. Good morning, Carolyn. Good morning, listeners. Good morning, Greg. Good morning, listeners.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
No, just to say there, Greg, just to mention that lady, now it may or may not be applicable to her or her daughter's case, but those that it is applicable to and can go forward for consideration, Greg, there still are options there for the SIE houses on your own land, or if you have a site and so on, etc., for people that may be able to deal with that.
Go ahead, Diana. Sorry, Michael. Go ahead, Diana.
You're on about the SIE houses. SIE houses, yes, have only rose again. They were off for a while, weren't they? And SIE houses, an experience with someone as well, applied for it when their daughter was a year old and never got the house built for 10 years.
Mm.
Waited 10 years for the house, stuck in a mobile. Every issue came arose. There was a problem with the water. There was a problem with the hedges. There was everything that they could possibly put against that person was, like, just held it up. And, like, there had to be actually a water treatment system put into that well, which cost atrocious money at that time.
Mm.
And this was in 1998. You know what I mean? So unless it has far changed, I can't see it being much better.
How many houses are we starting through that scheme, as far as you're aware, Michael?
Not very. The exact figure, Greg, offhand, I'm not fully aware of.
Do you know of any that have? Do you know of any that have started even through the SIE scheme?
I know of ones that have been done. Yes, and just to note on that as well, the SIE scheme has been there since I got elected onto the council. But the difficulty seems to be people either aren't fully aware of it, or just maybe like that lady says, what her friends' experience or whoever's family experience took the 10 years to get the house built. I don't know what. But, you know, that's a long time, obviously.
Do you think more needs to be done, Michael, as an elected rep? Do you think more needs to be done to close the gap between, you know, being unable to afford your own home but having decent resources, as Diana's family do, and then being able to qualify for council property?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Greg, of course, to do. The boundaries need to be broadened out here to accommodate everybody, like, to be fair. That certainly needs to be done. But just back again to the SIE house end of it, that scheme is there for anybody that either has a site, has a farm, is lucky enough to have that. I realise a huge amount of the population won't have that, but there's also a huge amount of the population that will. I do acknowledge as well what you're saying there, Greg. There's a lot of barriers in the way at the moment, even for getting on the social housing list that shouldn't be there, I believe, with income thresholds and so on. It's quite difficult there for people to get on, and that is just, you know, it's just slightly over 30,000 can either keep you inside the bracket, or a euro a say can knock you outside the bracket, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Same way then, accordingly, so many children and so on.
And I think too,
there's just a lot of red tape.
Yeah, and what I was going to say as well too, Michael, and this is no disrespect to you whatsoever, I just get the feeling from Diana, and correct me if I'm wrong, Diana, is that at this stage you've done all the talk and you want action now at this stage. You want solutions, you want a pathway for your daughter to have her forever home with her family.
Yeah, well, you can talk all you want, like, but any time, as far as the daughter's concerned, they're applying for mortgages and this and that and other. It's red tape, red tape, red tape, constantly. And, like, they're even looking for medical records of her partner because he was born with one kidney. And that was a whole issue, and had to go back and get medical records that he didn't even remember where he was at the time. You know, he was a young child at this stage.
I get you.
And you know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, they know he has only one kidney, so, like, you know, why make it an issue for a mortgage?
Yeah, okay.
You know.
Right, Diana, thank you very much indeed. Michael, how do people go about looking into the SI scheme, just in case it might work for them?
Well, they can go over to, they can contact the council director themselves and request a form out, or go on. They can request a form out from the council, or go on to the council website, do it that way. Or generally what most people do is they can get on to their public rep or public reps and ask them to advocate on their behalf. And it will be taken from there then, Greg, once the application will get started.
Okay.
First of all, the application is again, first of all, to see anyway, can they be considered, can all the boxes be ticked and so on. It goes on from there, and then obviously what I would suggest alongside that then, if those boxes are able to be achieved and be ticked, just work closely alongside your local representatives then to ensure then that you have a smooth journey going forward on the travel down that road, like, if that's possible for you.
Okay.
But I just can't, I can say to Carolyn, I just can't help but feel there's a lot of people aren't really fully aware of this, that this scheme is still going. So even like Diana said there, that, no, she wasn't aware of it in years and years, but the scheme is still there, but people need to ask for it and need to seek it out, like.
All right. Thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it. Let's say good morning now to Eamon. Hiya, Eamon.
Yes, Greg, how are you getting on?
I'm doing good. It's good to have you on the programme. And we're talking Ireland's facing really quite significant penalties for missing carbon reduction targets. What's your take on all of this?
Well, it was to do with an article in The Guardian there last week. I was reading it. It was about methane leaks. Now, the United Nations have these methane alerts, which they obviously send out to the oil and gas countries.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, Turkmenistan, it was about Turkmenistan, an old post-Soviet country, they wouldn't have interacted, but they started to interact and try to fix leaks. Now, the whole thing about methane is that actually, when you read some of the articles here, it traps 80 times more than carbon dioxide. And it causes about a quarter or 25% of global heating today. So it's a really toxic material going up into the atmosphere. And the thing about the leaks are, when you consider the amount of money involved in the oil and gas industry, they're relatively cheap and quick that they can do. You know, and that just stops the leak there and then, because some of the pipes would be probably corroded. Now, the whole thing about it is that the biggest emitters are obviously China, USA, Russia, India, Brazil, Pakistan, and Indonesia. And we'll just get to that in a wee minute. Because when you talk about the alerts, Turkmenistan tried to fix 20% of their alerts from the United Nations. But the USA, Iran, Russia, and China, they didn't actually have any response. No, and they are the big, and they are actually killing the planet, these countries. And there was one leak down in Mexico, and that was pumping out 37 tons per hour which was the equivalent of about 7 million SUVs. That's how toxic this stuff is.
Mm.
And that's why, that's why experts want to see the leaks fixed, because it's cheap, it's easy, and it's very efficient.
Yeah,
but
that being said, you're right. It's crazy, and they shouldn't. It shouldn't be leaking. But you know, 35% of 35% of methane gases come from these leaks. 40% from agriculture. 20% from waste. So we do have a responsibility for 60% of these methane emissions. That doesn't mean the 35% shouldn't go unchecked, I presume, Eamon.
Oh, no, no. When you put it into context, I'll tell you what it is. If you look, I was looking at the 2023 emissions, right? And in 2023, China was up about 1.9 billion, right? USA was 860 million. India was 941 million, Brazil 611, Russia 533, Indonesia was 421, Pakistan 241. They're all millions. But China's 1.9 billion. We, as a country, we're emitting 17 million, right?
Mm.
Tons. Now, if in 1 year, China emits as much deadly material that would take us 111 years. Right. 111 years. That means like, everybody on the planet is going to be dead.
Yeah.
Nobody loves now. That's how fast, no, a time scale. The USA is 50 years, India 55, and so on, so on, and so forth. But these countries are not, they're not, there's no penalties levied against them. Right? We're facing between 8 billion now, it's not million, 8 billion to 26 to 29 billion from the EU.
Mm.
But you also have to consider, Greg, that the EU has given waivers, right, to the oil and gas industry for 2027, 2028 and 2029, to prevent energy shortages, which means they're not going to get any penalties. But what about food shortages? 94% of all emissions come from agriculture. Fair enough, yeah. But surely there's a case to be made by our MEPs and our TDs to say to Europe, right, okay, you're giving a waiver to the oil and gas companies to prevent energy shortages. What about not food? Agriculture? It's not great if you could heat your home, but you've nothing to eat.
Yeah, so I get where you're coming from, but listening to you, Eamon, it's like everything you see. When everyone's pointing fingers at each other, we kind of get some sort of a standstill, don't we? Do you know, like, I think methane leaks are a major problem. And I think methane from agriculture is a major problem if you buy into the whole climate disaster narrative, which most people do. But we could just stand still and go, well, I'm not doing nothing because you're not doing nothing. Do you know what I mean? Or vice versa. And we don't get anywhere, really. We don't move any further. And I mean, we need oil and gas, and we need it at an affordable level, right? So if they didn't impose those breaks, could a litre of diesel go to €3? Do you know, because every action is a reaction. And the oil and gas companies have us by the proverbials.
Yeah. No, the whole thing is that there's about 10 countries and they are the major polluters. They're pumping toxic material and they do not spend a penny. Most of them do not spend a penny actually even to fix the leaks. And Turkmenistan was doing that for a while. They weren't fixing because of they had vast reservoirs of gas and oil and they just didn't bother. Now, those countries, you're not asking to sacrifice anything. We just go and fix the leaks, but they'll not do it. They'll not even look at it.
Yeah.
Because obviously Trump says climate change is a con job. And I know people, actually who agree with that, but it's you can stare at it in the face every month about catastrophes here and there, and different types of the weather changes. Because us being, We're the minnows, right? And might is right in this world of oil and gas. If you're a USA, China, or whatever, you do not take any notice of anybody
well,
else.
Can I push back a little bit on that? So I'll use China for an example. So whilst they're not addressing directly, you know, the emissions from the production of fossil fuels that you're talking of, they have a 15-year plan which directs the country's green transition targets to 25% share of non-fossil energy by 2030, and they will probably achieve that. A mandated reduction in emissions per unit of GDP by 17% up until 2030 again, aiming to raise electricity's share of final energy consumption to 35% by 2030. So whilst they're not necessarily addressing the headline stuff you're talking about, they are doing more than most other industrialised countries, and the more or the less reliant they come on fossil fuels, the lower these methane emissions will be. So is it fair for you to sort of frame these countries as doing nothing, Eamon, when it's demonstrable that they are?
Well, that's in the future that they are targeting this problem, but they don't have a massive bill hanging over their head like we do. They don't have a 30 billion euro bill waiting for them in 20.
Yeah, but that's a whole other kettle of fish, because our massive bill is artificially high because of it's factored against our GDP, which is ridiculous, right? Because we're constantly told not to rely on corporation tax, yet our carbon emissions targets are based on the wealth of the country. It's crazy. And then we decided to actually say, oh, well, they're not strong enough. So our targets are way above countries of a similar size and similar output because of this blooming corporation tax. That shouldn't have happened. We should have tried to negotiate a lower target and say, look, we're not relying on this GDP because we know it's not going to last forever. Yet here we are faced with massive bills as a result.
Yeah, but we should have said to them, listen, why did they give the oil and gas companies a waiver? And the European oil and gas companies a waiver.
Because
and they cited energy security.
Because oil and gas hold all the cards, Eamon, and if we don't give them their breaks, me and you end up paying for it anyway. Like they still need to get to work. So they don't give them breaks. We pay for it again.
No. But Mike is right. Okay. Mike is right.
Well, that's true.
And if these companies are actually leading what the EU is dictating. Like, I mean, but surely food shortages should be protected, and that's actually come down to us, because 94% of our emissions is from agriculture. So we could say, listen, you need to protect food, so you need to protect the agricultural.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, really, this kind of sounds like we're arguing who is more right to destroy the planet rather than figuring it all out. But I get where you're coming from, Eamon. Go ahead. Final point to you briefly, if you don't mind.
No, well, I just think this is not only unfair, it's unjust, cruel and dishonest, because major polluters do not pay a penny. And by deliberately not fixing their leaks, well, to my mind, that's actually tantamount nearly to criminal activity. They actually don't give it a word, and they will just pump and pump and pump that methane up.
Okay.
But anyway.
Thanks, Eamon. Good stuff. Well done. Thank you. Brendan Devaney joins me on the programme now as we look forward to the DL debate live after 7 this evening. Hello, Brendan.
Hello, Craig.
How was your weekend?
Good, busy, yeah. A few late nights, so...
We always get straight to the late nights.
I know. Sorry, I just have a problem.
I feel like I'm your Monday morning therapist.
You are. You do pick me up on a Monday. Now. Otherwise, I would be hiding in a dark room somewhere.
Hey, listen, it's good to have you on board. Right, so the championship starting to take shape. St. Eunan's, Gwydor, Dunloe, Neve Connell. They're in the quarterfinals. They are safe, but we have some tasty... sort of pre-quarterfinal matches to look forward to after yesterday's round of games.
Yeah, that's it, Greg. And I suppose a lot of people say this is the real championship now, getting to that knockout stage where it's all on the line on the day. That's what championship's about. And let's say different people have different opinions on the format and is it too slow to start? And, you know, obviously there's a couple of teams in there that made the P quarterfinal, Greg, that lost three games and won a game. So, you know, people might have their own ideas about that. But listen, that's where we're at for now. And I think it's been, sometimes I suppose the draw can be a bit tough on certain teams, but depending on who you get. But certainly, I think Niamh Collins at Union, say Dunloe and Gidore, they all finished top of the pile. So you have four masters playing St Michael's now, Kilkear, Niamh Columba, Glenswilly, Termon, and McCool's Downing. So yeah, some definitely interesting games on there. And I think probably the Glenswilly Termon one is probably the big of it.
Yeah, and just that with the jeopardy that's there, they become huge games, don't they? The whole season sort of hangs on these knockout games, and hence your comment that it really is the business end of things now.
Yeah, I guess it's a thing, Greg. You look at, obviously, we watch a lot of football, Premier League, and that, you know, you've league competitions, which are week and week, and then you have something like the Championship, which is about on the line. Now, a lot of people will talk about the best Championship in Ulster, Tyrone. It's knockout from the get-go, which seems quite harsh, but our old format used to be, you know, you had a home game and an away game, and then possibly a third game. And I think after that, that settled into the quarter, semi and final. I think that format, to be honest, would be better, because what's happened is the league's become a bit of a real pre-season competition. You've people away and not caring that much about it, because you can kind of find your way into the Championship. You don't have to start like ready to go, particularly the bigger teams, Greg. They can come in a wee bit cold it and then build their way to it, which again isn't what Championship's supposed to be about.
Does this not allow, though, teams to emerge over seasons, you know what I mean, get more game time against the big teams, develop the squads, maybe have more teams that can compete at the top level over time? Is that the, I don't know if that's the motivation, but does it work like that? In other words, what might the advantage be of retaining this current format? I know you're against it, but what's the argument for it?
Well, I guess it gives people loads of chances, and It turns the Championship into obviously a group phase situation first. And listen, Greg, I agree it can bring teams on, but there's certainly, I don't know if it's that, but there is now six or seven teams will say, listen, we can have a crack at this Championship. Mm. Sure, there's a couple of out and out favourites, but I think any of those other four or five teams can beat those top couple of teams on a given day. So there definitely has been a levelling out. I don't know if that's much to do with the Championship or just clubs getting their act together and getting their squads right, coaching their S&C. There's a lot of teams doing a tremendous amount of work in the background to get themselves up to that next level. So, yeah, it's just that feeling of Championship sometimes, Greg. You go to games and it doesn't have a Championship cut to it. So I think needs a wee bit of tweaking, because, as I say, if you lose three games in the Championship, Greg, and you won one and you're in a quarter final, I don't know if that sits too well in terms of the competitive football.
Yeah, it does seem a bit weird, doesn't it? And it means the games that come before it are, for the big teams, warm-up games, and for the smaller teams, a waste of space, really, because you know you just have to pull it out of the bag. Okay, I get you. Anyway, listen, I'm bluffing here. You're going to have the big names talking about the big games this evening. You can steal that if you wish. Brendan Kilcoyne, obviously, Kevin Cassidy, Maureen O'Donnell. Right, so what else is going to be talked about this evening?
Yeah, listen, we're going to go through all the Championships. Obviously, you know, we've Intermediate Junior as well. We've the Ladies' Championship, Bo's coming on to talk about that there. And I suppose, Greg, kind of what you said there makes me think, you know, obviously Kelly Beggs had a brilliant last day, won, as did Niamh Columba, who come up from Intermediate. So, you know, I suppose there's something in that. Everybody's just trying to grow a bit in it. And I suppose in that, Greg, in those Championship games, you have opportunities to do that. I guess that's why maybe the league should be, if the league was taken more seriously, that's probably where you should get that type of training in and get ready for the Championship, because I think that's the two different types of football. League football is league football. Championship should be cut and thrust stuff. I think we're probably missing a bit of that. So I think it's probably up to clubs to maybe take the league more seriously and then a shorter Championship and make it Championship. I think that's the key.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you always need, whether it's inter-county or club football, a clear distinction between the league and the Championship, but actually to make, you know, both important, but not to the detriment of the biggie, which is the bread and butter of the Championship.
Well, you've seen that with the All-Ireland series, Greg. They've obviously tinkered with it, realising that the group stages was leaving games a wee bit flat, and then you'd maybe have a game at the end, which wouldn't have meant anything to anybody. So they tinkered with that and made it more of a rolling kind of Championship, took out a couple of games. and made it a bit more unpredictable. I suppose that's the thing, Greg. We need every game for something to be on the line rather than teams kind of cruising through it. But listen, it's going to be all on the line now. We're hitting crunch time and some fascinating games, because I think whoever comes through those quarterfinals, the pre-quarterfinals, I think all of them will fancy a cut at the top four that's in there. So I think we're going to have some great games. And years gone by, Greg, we didn't have that. You know, teams that were definitely going to come through a lot of the games and be in the semi-finals and finals. But I think it's definitely changing. So fair play to the clubs for pulling up their squads and making themselves more competitive.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. All right, and it's going to be a brilliant show. It's live just after 7 this evening, and of course available for you to podcast very shortly thereafter. You will be across everything that happened in both the women and men's game at the weekend in this county. And as you can see from Brendan there, there's going to be quite a bit of interesting debate. I can tell already about the old championship structure. What does Kilcoyne and Castley think, for an example? You'll find out tonight. Thanks very much. Brendan, look after yourself. Bye-bye. Right, Brendan Devenny there. Let us see. We've a lot coming up on the programme, of course, still in the next hour. We're going to be reflecting on Katie Taylor's goodbye. Not the fight. The fight in and of itself was designed to be what it was to be. There's some fantastic opponents out there that Katie could have had a fight with, but that's not what it was about. It was about the fairy tale. Once upon a time it was billed, and every good fairy tale needs a happy ending, and they made sure that happened. But historic, nonetheless. That and so much besides coming up in a few minutes. Right, let's get to some communications. We got this email in relation to school transport. I'd like to thank Highland Radio sincerely for their assistance in sourcing a bus ticket for my daughter Helena. I was on air on the 4th of August, and shortly afterwards, Bus Éireann issued Helena a ticket. After this experience, I pledge to help others in the same situation. Please can you give a shout out to the refused students in Letterkenny area and pass on my mobile number. We'll retain that here. Their refusal must be submitted to schooltransportappeals.ie, followed by an email to Hazel Ward in Port Leash. She was responsible for Donegal Schools. I will only be... in other words, we have all of these details here. There's far too many of them for me to read out, but we can't really post it on socials either, but give us a call. We can pass that information on to you if you are... stuck. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number. 086 60 25000. You can give us a call on 074 91 25000 also. Right, let us go to our next guest on the programme, and that is Sadie Duffy from Buncrana. Hiya, Sadie.
Good morning, Greg.
How are you?
I'm good. All okay. Good. Why not?
You've been on
after
this...
After the weekend we've had.
That's it indeed. Sadie, you've played an important part in Katie's career from the very beginning and giving her a platform, and you were also a judge in one of her contests. Take us back to your first dealings with the young Katie Taylor.
Oh, we're going back now. Oh God, Greg, that's a wee lifetime ago, almost 25 years ago plus. When we actually initiated the movement to get the women and girls involved, not saying involved, but to kind of get them moving on to the next level within boxing. It was there was a lot of hurdles kind of in our way, but we had a good working committee nationwide representing all the provinces. And everyone was a driving force behind it, and eventually got recognition to have the girls compete at competition level. Now, it wasn't championship level, but at least it gave them a platform where they could come together for training, spars, and then have like open bouts and with eventual decisions. And then eventually then we got the championship status, which meant then that they had the right to box like the boys in the national championships, and they became national champions eventually. So it has developed significantly from all of that. But in that middle bit then in between, there was an international tournament with Ireland versus England. And the committee, but we were working closely with Pete Taylor, that was Katie's dad, and a number of other coaches, and Mercedes Taff from Sligo. A lot of your listeners will remember Mercedes. She was the head coach with the Alan Reynolds and Stephen Reynolds, the Reynolds brothers down in Sligo. I think between them they have maybe 10 or 11 national senior titles, as it was back then. So like Mercedes was a good asset to have on board with the Women's Committee to head up the coaching side of things. And she did tremendous work there too as well. So that eventually then, they made the matches herself and Pete in conjunction with the IABA, the Central Council. And we got three contests on the bill on the tournament that night. Now, two of them was classed as internationals, but Katie and Alana was like a domestic contest, but they were the first two boxers, two geared boxers in the ring, so which was significant at that on that night.
Yeah, 23-12, she pointed Alana in that fight. And you know, they're talking about making this into a Netflix film, and why not? You know, this idea of her having to, you know, almost pretend to be a boy to get in training into amateur boxing, the push that she put on to get women's boxing recognised as an Olympic event, really quite remarkable. And you brought her up to Bunkrana too in her amateur career, did you not?
She was up once, yeah, with a spar, and like, but she's travelled the length and breadth of the country too as well with her dad. You know, like at that time it was about getting the girls notoriety, getting them competition, getting them out there, because there wasn't a significant number of girls. There was lots of girls then eventually came into clubs, but Katie and Alana and a number of other girls were that wee bit more advanced because they'd been in clubs before all of this kind of took off, if that maybe makes sense, Greg. So they were a lot more skilled and, as I say, more experienced too as well. But she definitely... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. She definitely...
She definitely like broke down barriers and pushed the door open for other young girls and women to be brave enough and approach their local boxing clubs and to get in there to train.
You mentioned her dad. Now, I know there was something of a falling out, but even before that, I was amazed to learn that from himself. He said in an interview that he had never seen Katie Taylor fight live before Saturday night. What a remarkable statistic that is.
I know, like, we're not going to get into the ins and outs of all that. That's personal between them, or Katie and her family. But it's been well documented that there was a falling out, and it happens, do you know what I mean, in life. But unfortunately for Katie, it was just at a bad moment in time in her career after the what happened in Rio and everything. And that's when you do really need to have a strong support network around you. And things happened, but thankfully she was strong enough and she had a really good family network there to support her. And she took time and she went, looked at all her avenues. And that's when she decided then after that to look at the professional side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, the rest is history.
Now, talk to me about your memories of Saturday night.
Saturday night, oh my God. We were there like from early on, watched all the other support bouts. Like the atmosphere was building and building, but like the crescendo, as they say, was ultimately whenever Katie's contest was 15, 20 minutes away from starting. The build-up was phenomenal with Westlife and everything. The atmosphere was electric. And like, I'm sure even the people watching on television like could even anticipate what the atmosphere was like. But being there on the pitch and experiencing it, Greg, it was absolutely amazing.
We've talked about what she's contributed in the amateur game and also in the professional game. I've quoted this conversation that Eddie Hearn was having with the media 10, 12 years ago. She had texted him, he texted her back. He said, you know, I don't know where women's boxing is going, but Katie Taylor is going to be a superstar. It's astonishing what women's boxing has become and what she's left behind. And it really is all traceable back to her and her drive, the same drive to get women's amateur boxing recognised, to get professional boxing on the map. She's single-handedly started that ball rolling.
Absolutely, 100%. And it took a lot of persuading. And Katie has said that in her interviews previously, even with Eddie Hearn, to get him to take a chance with her, basically, is maybe not the right choice of words, but you kind of know what I mean. And she persuaded him, and in fairness to him, he did that. And she was very, very consistent in the group of people that she has around her. You look at over the years from she signed professional with Eddie and Brian Peters and then her coach and everything. Nothing has changed. She's worked the same group of people that's been there to support her right through. And that in itself says a lot, because you have to have consistency. And as again, Katie, she had done what she'd done. She did the test matches before the London Olympics and went to the top and let them see what the level of women's boxing was. It was accepted into the London Games in 2012. And she was the first Irish woman to win a gold medal. And a significant on that in the London Olympics as well, that Nikki Adams, who also boxed in the same bill with Katie in October 2001, also won the gold medal. So that was two of the boxers that competed in that international in Dublin almost 25 years ago, won two gold medals in London 2012.
Amazing stuff. Okay, listen, thank you for helping us reflect on the weekend and on Katie Taylor's career. I mean, it's never going to be repeated where someone will have such an influence on a sport, to be undisputed three times, to be able to retire at the top at 40 and to walk away into the arms of her family and to fill out Croke Park. I just can't see the stars ever aligning for it to ever happen again. And, you know, the big boxing memory in Croke Park previously was Muhammad Ali. Well, she walked out his tunnel and a set a bar I don't think can be reached again, Sadie. You never say never, but it's very hard to see how the stars could align again like this.
Absolutely, Greg. It's going to take a long time, I believe, before that ever happens again, as you say. But, like, let's wait and see. We still have a lot of talent out there, both the boys and the girls. And, like, Ireland is one of the stronger nations to be reckoned with, even at the present day, across European and world-level boxing. So there is, and I would hope, and I do believe, that even after Saturday night's performance and the millions of young people around the world that have tuned in to watch Katie and the people that were there present in Croke Park, like, if it's not boxing, there's a sport out there for everyone.
Yep.
Go to your local club, be it football, Gaelic, tennis, whatever. Do a sports taster. You'll always get something that will fit your size, as they say. And give it a go.
All right.
Give it a go. Stuff.
All right, Sadie, give it a go. That's it. Thank you very much indeed, Sadie Duffy there. We're talking now about Letterkenny CDP. They're hosting Suicide Awareness Day. Let's talk, let's listen, let's support. James Devaney of Letterkenny CDP is with me in studio. Good morning to you. Thanks for calling up.
Morning, Greg.
Right, so talk to me about this day. And it focuses really on a two-hour window, doesn't it, on the 10th of September?
Yeah. It's on the 10th of September, Thursday, from 1 p.m. until 3 p.m. On the day, there will be some speakers there with lived experience. There'll be refreshments there. There will also be information from organisations who help families and who help people in distress, but also help families recovering from a suicide bereavement as well. And we will also, in the middle of that two-hour window as well, we will also be having a remembrance service where people can come together and remember their loved one, their friend, their brother, their mother, their whoever it was that passed by suicide, that they can do that together as a group and support one another through it. Like, ultimately, it is about supporting each other through these times.
We're also joined in studio by Brian. Thanks for joining us, buddy. How are you?
Not too bad. How's things, Greg?
Good. I appreciate it. And I know it's not easy speaking out publicly about your own experiences. It started very early for you, didn't it, when you should have been just enjoying things kids enjoy and all that type of stuff. It got tough early for you.
Yeah, I suppose for myself now, my own experience, I suppose, looking back, sexually abused at 10. And I took my first drugs, you know, at about 12 years of age. It was a joint of hash before school one time. And I think I remember a guy giving it to me, you know, he said, this will help you forget things. And that was it for me. It was kind of hook, line and sinker. But you know, it wasn't up until I was 18 years of age I was put into a mental hospital, and that was the first time I ever actually spoke about the abuse.
Yeah.
So I suppose, you know, up from the age of 12 up to 18, you know, I would have had multiple suicide attempts, and going past that, you know, I got a bit of help at 18, like, but there was a lot of damage done within them 8 years.
In relation to the drug dependency, that first joint so early on, are they two separate things, if you know what I mean? Were you drawn to drugs because of the abuse, or are these almost two separate things? If the, you know, in other words, you were abused, which is absolutely horrendous, but you were also in circles whereby drugs also became available.
I think for me, I suppose the drugs really, it allowed me to kind of keep secret. You know, it helped me push things down, yeah, you know. So I suppose for me, really, it was more a survival tool than anything at the time.
Yeah, and this is where you step into that vicious circle, because you get a habit whereby you have to fund that habit.
Yeah.
So early doors, 15, 16, you're trying to get money together to pay for the drugs.
Oh, yeah, and that would, you know, I suppose like anybody in that situation, the desperation kicks in, you know, when you start sober up or whatever and you have to live with your emotions and stuff. So, yeah, obviously throughout my life, you know, you've done a lot of things for money, you know, stealing, whatever it is, you know, to try and get stuff or whatever. But, you know, it ultimately brought me down a very bad road, hey, and I suppose, like I am where I am now, thankfully, you know, it's all due to the services around it. And I was being able to be willing to talk to people, you know, to be
able
to put
the hand
out.
And that's where we get to the important part of it. But, I mean, you weren't aware of those services at 15. And I mean, I don't know where you were mentally at that time, but can you bring us into the space that would leave a 15-year-old thinking that this is the right option, that this is the best option for them?
I suppose, you know, like, obviously, you're probably thinking about now about my parents and stuff like that, like, obviously, you know, with the head I have now. I suppose I would have had a lot more help if I was more honest about it, you know, if I could have opened up. I think at the time, you know, I was probably just so ashamed. Brought up an awful lot of stuff, I suppose, you know, regarding your sexuality then going forward in life and everything else. So I suppose a lot of the thoughts I would have had, I was trying to bury them because I had no real guidance on anything. There was nobody, no mentor or anybody above me, because I wouldn't put my hand out, you know, and I think that was the biggest problem.
Yeah, but
the
abusers exploit this. The abusers exploit this. The victim, you know, you were a victim in the act, and you were a victim in what comes following that because of all the reasons that you've just outlined. And I just, sometimes I hope people that might be responsible for this type of stuff or have it in their mind, think about this, you know, think about what impact they're going to have on someone's life for the rest of their lives. So, I mean, the 18 years, obviously, it's a mixture then of your own mental anguish, drugs, nicking stuff, getting a bit of a reputation, police knocking on the door, Gardaí knocking on the door. That was your teenage years. Then come 18, how did you end up in a mental hospital?
So I suppose at the time, you know, I was had suicide attempts leading up to it. I was actually away at a time anyway, and a guard had actually seen me walking up the road with a rope. And luckily enough, you know, that guard definitely saved my life. So they had actually brought me down to this mental hospital. And obviously there, when I was there, you know, it was the first time I ever kind of expressed what had actually happened to me. You know, the doctors and everyone there was kind of trying to figure out, they were saying there had to be some other reason why I was in the situation.
What was that like when you were able to unburden yourself from that secret that you've kept?
It was like the first time I took a deep breath in my life. You know, it was the first time I could actually breathe. And it just, everything started to make sense. I was so emotional, so erratic. Everything kind of just hit me like a, it was like throwing a brick through a window nearly.
Yeah.
It was like the glass shattering, you know, everything kind of came to a head. And, you know, it took a long time even after that to just kind of get into some sort of peace. Like, you know, I've been in and out of counselling for years, and I had to see a psychologist then for about a year and a half after that. And I kind of thought I had ironed things out, you know, but addiction kind of really came back into my life, you know, throughout life. And alcohol really became a massive part of my story, you know. And just, you know, I'm 36 now, so I've had plenty of suicide attempts even there recently. I think the last one I had was 2 years ago in November. But to see where I am now today from where I was 2 years ago, you know, addiction free, you know, it's huge stuff.
So you were still on one substance or another a couple of years ago. Booze had replaced it.
Substituting everything.
And was that kind of seen as the lesser of the drugs because it's so normalised in society? So, listen, I'm not going to do the illegal stuff, but booze is okay.
Yeah. But pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, everybody is.
So you justify it, right? Yeah. It's legal, so it can't do me any harm. And I want a kick, and I want an opportunity to get out of my mind, and that's it. And next thing you know, it's just another addiction. And I think, you know, that because we often say And I think you've demonstrated perfectly, Brian, with your honesty there. The first step is the talk, right? Because your journey the last 18 years has not been easy either. But it probably could not have happened without you divulging what you'd been through, your abuse. I think you'd probably be dead by now.
100%.
If you get, so life is not easy. And we get these, we often get these stories of people have a really bad time. They get to the low, they reach out, and then life's great and they've written a book.
That's not always the case.
That's not it. Yeah. But that being said, in that 18 years, it wouldn't exist. And there's been a lot of positive, I presume, as well. And this is where we've got to now, right? Yeah. With the rest, most of your life still ahead of you. Yeah. Right. So that's kind of underlines, James, the importance, as difficult as it is.
Yeah.
And I want people who are like Brian there and have bottled it up, you know, and are coping or think they're coping or they think they're living. You know what I mean? It's good. It is good genuinely to talk. It's kind of become a phrase that sticks in my throat a bit now, but it is.
Yeah, yeah. And it certainly breaks down the stigma around, you know, that whole mesh of addiction, mental health, trauma. That and there's no coincidence that World Suicide Prevention Day falls in the middle of Recovery Month, which we work a lot at ourselves down in CDP, and we have it's about, I suppose, seeing the link between them all. Not sometimes you have to separate them, and sometimes you have to work on them together. Every person's individual, and like Brian's case, you know, it is about making that, for encouraging people to make that first step, that first saying to somebody, look, come here, my life hasn't exactly been a bed of roses. Here's what's going on in my head. And it's taking that chance and encouraging people to take that risk and just say to another human being, whether it's a friend, a work colleague or somebody, you know, it takes some of that pressure away from it, that we can actually share it with somebody else. And then eventually, and it does help other people to say, well, hold on, you know, if Brian can do this, maybe I could take the same chance here as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what Thursday's all about, taking away the stigma. Like, we hold it in the middle of the Courtyard. It's not out in the open, the Courtyard Shopping Centre, but our office is in the Courtyard Shopping Centre. It's in the heart of the community where people can come. We have a quiet room and where people can come and gather. It's a public place, but at the same time, we have our own place there where people can come, gather, connect, talk, and remember. Mm. And remember.
Brian, for you, in your experience, have you sort of, does it feel like you've got a bit more control now over your story rather than other people or other factors, in that, like, say, for instance, you know, you still have the legal route open to you if you so wish, yeah, whenever you're ready, if that's what you want to do. Do you feel like you've got more control over yourself rather than you had when everything was bottled up?
Oh, I definitely have a lot more control over my life, I suppose, because everything, I suppose, you know, it's my thoughts and my behaviours have changed drastically, you know. But I suppose going forward, you know, for me, really, like, yeah, I'll have to go down the justice route at some point, you know, to say a lot of people that I've talked to or whatever throughout their own experiences, that most people only get healing, I suppose, when they've actually got justice for their cases. So, you know, I would urge anybody out there, you know, I've talked to a lot of people in my life about this stuff. That if there is something like that going on for you, you know, it's not just about getting out and talking about people. There's a lot of other challenges in your recovery from addiction or molestation or whatever it is, to follow up. Like, but yeah, look, it's a hard road. Like, I'm not going to lie, you know, it's not as easy as it is just opening up and saying, here, look, I have a problem here. At the moment, there's work to be put into. Like, but I think one of the main messages is, like, once you realise you're not alone, like, you're not the only person going through this. There's other people out there.
Yeah, but I also think, you know, what you've proven as well is persistence. Because, I mean, you know, you've been trying to do this with huge challenges that someone or something put in your way. And yet you've stuck at it. You've had your highs and you've had your lows. And yet here you are now, because of your resilience and because of who you are, 2 years clean and the better for it. But also in a reality that it's a constant piece of work. So, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier on about Katie Taylor and what she's achieved. That's because she's never given up. You know, she's always fought for herself and what she believes in. And that's what you've done. And you're like a Katie Taylor as well, because you are where you are now because you didn't give up, or you won't give up, which I think is brilliant.
I appreciate that.
And I hope you're very proud of yourself, because it really is amazing what you've done. and dealing with other stuff, family stuff. Your brother had an incident recently as well. So, you know, stuff that could be triggering very easily. You've stuck with it, you know, and I think that's brilliant.
I really appreciate that.
White Oaks Rehabilitation Unit, important to you, wasn't it?
Very, very important. Very important. You know, I went in there 2 years ago and I have to say, like, probably one of the best things I've ever done in my life. And I used to sit there and think, is that a really sad thing to say too? But it's not, because it's given me so much, you know, going forward. Like, just there 2 years ago, you know, I would have been in the depths of my addiction, very suicidal again. And I really was questioning, you know, was it worth kind of continuing the fight on? Like, but to see where I am now, you know, I've gained so much in recovery. Hey, it's something special, like something really special. And it is, you know, just hold on to that title, you know, hold on to a bit of faith or a bit of hope, because it is there. Yeah. It is just about reaching out, hey.
James, for me, Brian's stories are the real stories, the most important stories. And there's no hierarchy here, okay?
No.
I'm not trying to. But we did for a long time in presenting this conversation. It was a former footballer, won 5 All-Irelands, hit the bottle, lost their wife, and then they're better again, and we have a new book out describing it. And as I say, I'm not saying that that's not a valid story. Don't get me wrong.
No, no.
But it's important that we hear real people's stories.
Yes.
Does that make sense? And as I say, this is not to create any hierarchy in mental health or crisis, and everyone's journey is different.
No.
But we have to make sure all the stories are relatable to everybody.
Yeah.
That it's tough still. It's tough still,
and as Brian says, it's someone... It's not just a case of talking once and that's it dealt with. There's it can be a long journey, and it's working at it and maintaining that. You know, like, people often think if I go to White Oaks, I just do 28 days and that's the end of it. But there's a 2-year aftercare program, and then there's a lot of other meeting people for coffee, and it's getting out what's inside your head that doesn't build up and build up and build up to a pressure, to a point of where picking up a drink, picking up a drug, because to pick up a drink or to pick up a drug, it brings back all those old feelings of guilt, shame, remorse, that maybe ending it all becomes a solution in our head again.
I mean, alcohol, drugs, they're very fickle friends. They're fine for a little while, I presume.
They're not good company.
And then after that, they make you feel worse, don't they?
Yeah,
right, okay. And, you know, life can be tough as well.
Yes.
Outside of an addiction. And, you know, obviously, substance abuse, certainly history of having your childhood taken from you by some evil, I can't even use the words, that is also another cross to bear. But talking is so important. That initial conversation, you heard it directly there from Brian. Letterkenny CDP Suicide Awareness. Let's talk, let's listen, let's support. Guest speakers, light refreshments, service providers, a remembrance ceremony. It's a 2 hours. It's not a huge commitment. 1 to 3 p.m. on the 10th of September. And that first engagement might be that clarity that Brian got from his first sort of chat.
And even last year during that remembrance service in the middle, like, it was very, very poignant. And afterwards, where families come together and they talked about their brother, they talked about their son, they talked about their wife. And to see it become very, very real when we've seen all the wee hearts up on the tree on the wall. And some hearts had 2 or 3 names on them. You know, and every one of them has been through their own individual stories. It could be Micah. It could be trauma. It could be childhood trauma. It could be addiction. It could be mental health. It could be anxiety. It could be so many different things.
Mm.
You know, and it's given people a chance that it could be poverty, whatever it is, that there is people out there to talk to. And it's just saying, look, hold on here, pulling somebody to one side. We have staff there on the day that if people just pull us aside, we will be able to signpost people on to the relevant services on the day as well.
Finally, Brian, you know, we often talk about all the services that are there, that, you know, the state-run services, and that's fine, and there are problems and all that kind of stuff. I'm just curious, from your perspective, what it felt like or what it feels like to know, even when you don't at times, you hadn't cared for yourself, that there are so many other people like James, like the crew up at White Oaks and hundreds of others, that there are so many other people that actually care about you. What was that like, realising that?
It was amazing. Amazing, yeah. Because I think like anything, your self-worth, you know, your self-belief is on the floor. And for anybody, for anyone at all, to see some sort of hope in you or see some sort of shine in you, you know, it's massive stuff. Because if you can't see it in yourself, somebody else might. And that can be just a little spark you need to kind of get yourself up off your bum.
All right, listen, best of luck with the future.
Really appreciate it.
Keep it up. Two years clean. No mean achievement, that. It's fantastic. And you too, James, what is the situation in terms of attendance? Do you roll up? Do you book in advance? Or
No. Just roll up on the day. Everybody's welcome, whether you're a family member, whether you work in services. It's open to the whole community. Anybody at all. Like last year, I think we had about 70 or 80 people there on the day. We had it in a setting, a very comfortable setting, and people were very... It was... One person said to us afterwards, he says, fair play to you at CDP. You just had the B-A-L-L-S to have a conversation and to take away that stigma, you know. And he says, you just actually grasped the bunch of nettles and you just did it. Other people would shy away from it because what of this and what of that and what of this and what of that. But he says, that's a community organisation there doing something like that, responding to a need within the community. And like... This all came out of a conversation one time we had during our tea break, and there was one or two deaths by suicide in the community that weekend, and there were seven or eight of us sitting around, and every single person around that table knew another two or three. Mm. And when they went back a couple of years, they knew another two or three. You know, and
it's
we just
says, no, underreported.
Yes, we need to be, because sometimes it could be reported as a single vehicle car crash. It could be recorded as an accident. It could be recorded as, you know, like somebody found maybe that it could be recorded as a drug overdose. It's, you know, as you say, it's under-recorded, and we thought, no, we need to respond to this within the community.
And in fairness, I know the Coroners Association are trying to just work in that regard, because unless we get the actual, because it's always equated with road traffic collisions, because the figures count, but one is incredibly underreported compared to the other. And unless we have the real facts and the real numbers, we can't then put the right resources in. So that's why that's so critically important.
Yeah.
Brian, thank you. James Devaney of Letterkenny CDP, thank you. New figures from the HSE show just one in seven hospital consultants on the new public-only contracts are working on a Saturday, while just one in three are working extended day shifts. It comes as hospitals prepared for increased pressure over the winter months. Now, the journalist who wrote this, you can see they're of a certain view, because they put the word just in there a couple of times, so they're coming up to some sort of a conclusion. Dr. Louise Morins, a consultant anaesthetist at Letterkenny University Hospital. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Now, people should understand that what goes on in situations like this, where you've got the HSC, the Minister for Health, and you've got hospital consultants and workers, is there's a battle for public minds as well. There's a battle for public opinion, and there's a little bit of that going on. So what do you think of those raw figures as I've read them to you, Louise?
I'm not one bit surprised. I think this, the idea about a six-day working week for the hospitals is a brilliant idea. It's a great idea, and it's been poorly executed. They have resources barely enough for 5 days a week, and have asked us to use the same resources to deliver that for 6 days a week, which means that at some point, if you're working on a Saturday, then you can't be there on the following Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever day of the week it is. So who looks after those clinics, those operating lists, those inpatients on the day that you're off? But on top of that, you know, if you, for example, take a surgical consultant or a medical consultant to do an extra list on a Saturday, if there's no extra nurses, extra radiographers, pharmacists, you know, physios, OT, speech and language, you know, healthcare assistants, admin on the Saturday, then it's pointless having a clinic. It will just be the most inefficient clinic that won't work or run, or you can't actually run it. So one in seven, I think, is probably an exaggeration. I don't think one in seven are actually working extra resources on a weekend. So obviously we all work weekends for emergency work the whole time. There's always a full complement of consultants on 24/7. But what the Minister for Health, I think, is looking for is for extra delivery of routine work on a Saturday. Do I think that's happening in one in seven consultants? I don't. I think I think some hospitals have counted their emergency work as a day of routine work. I think they've manipulated the figures to please the minister. Do I think that even... So I don't think it's even as high as 1 in 7, because unfortunately they haven't provided the resources to deliver this,
yes,
so 6 days a week.
So this is like if I were to say, well, we need an extra bed in Letterkenny, should just buy the bed. Sure, it's only a bit of metal with a mattress on it, but there is a certain amount of staff that is required for, you know, every bed or every multiples of beds. So if you are working on a Saturday, the consultant just doesn't go in on their own. There is a whole support team that also need to be there and available.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I am not a physician, but take the physicians, for example, because they have the majority of the patients in the hospital. If they go in to do a routine ward round, not an emergency ward round, and they wanted the same level of service available to them to support them on their ward round, they would need some... NCHDs, so some non-consultant hospital doctors. They would need some senior nursing staff. They would need their secretaries and their admin to help print out and get all of the discharge letters. They'd need physio, OT, social workers, you know, the healthcare assistants, all of those things to help them go round. Now, obviously, some of them are there, like the nurses, but maybe the CNM3s that help run the ward and make all of the sort of efficiencies happen aren't there on a Saturday. So
yes,
they need to be as well.
So those are resources. They're great human beings, don't get me wrong, but there are resources. Is it possible, like between your radiologists, your pharmacy, nurses, admin staff, etc., that we could be better managing their time so to ensure that we can cover the 6 days with what we've been covering? Like, I can't imagine we're managing them right now optimally. Is there any... Do you think there's any headroom there that we could make better use of those resources to try and cover the 6 days?
Okay, so it's difficult for me to 100% answer this because obviously I don't work in those subspecialties. I can tell you in some of those areas, absolutely no way could they be optimised anymore. So, for example, speech and language therapists, there are not enough of them. They can barely cover a skeleton service Monday to Friday. Radiographers, for example, on a Friday, there is not enough radiographers to cover outpatients. So if you go to outpatients and you need an X-ray on a Friday, you cannot get one. There is not enough radiographers. So they are spread extremely thinly in certain areas where they're just not the resources to cover. So I don't think no matter how you manage them, they haven't got the numbers to fill in. In terms of nurses on the ground, if you're talking about... Oh, God, I'm going to get myself shot by some nurses. But if you're talking about more junior nurses, there's not enough of them. We've got this WTE cap across the whole of the West Northwest. And it doesn't matter if a nurse leaves, then that counts as a WTE. And sometimes the management are taking that WTE and giving it to a consultant and then they're down a nurse or to somebody else where they didn't really want it. So the nurses are, from a sort of the kind of the foot soldiers point of view, they are down. I can't tell you about the management from nurses. Like, for example, I don't know enough, but I think what you're saying is, for example, if on Monday to Friday there's a CNM1, CNM2, CNM3 in a ward, could you spread those out over the 6 days rather than five? I like the theory. I couldn't tell you for sure, but the theory potentially, but usually most of those people are allocated a role. I know I can tell you where I work most of the time, which is in theatre. And in theatre, each of the CNM1s are in charge of running a specific type of theatre, like an elective orthopaedic theatre. So they've got specialist knowledge in that area. So if you take them out and put that person on a Saturday, then you run your elective lists on a week when they're not there,
exactly, then that
list won't be running
complex
as efficiently.
And this is why I think... No, I get you, and that makes perfect sense, because every action, there's a reaction. So if you, it's not as simple as it might seem. And this is why I think, you know, I wonder, does the health minister get this? Because it's very easy to put this kind of information out there and then it comes across as, you know, lazy consultants who want to eat their cake and still have it, right? And that might put pressure on them and this, that and then... We really do all need to, all sides of this, have the full nuanced conversation I think we're having now, because consultants are there, they'll do it, but the other staff need to be there. They need to be recruited, or they need to be better managed, or whatever it might be, most likely recruitment. So we all need to be pulling in the one direction, because we're not going to get anywhere pointing blame. You haven't pointed blame at anyone, but you know where I'm coming from.
No, I completely agree. If you ask my colleagues in the anaesthetic department, all of us said that we'd work a Saturday. I mean, we all... There's 13 of us, and 12 of us do on call, and two every single day at the weekend as well. So that we're doing 1 in 6 days, sort of 24-hour shifts. So if we do on top of that as well, we all said that we would, but there's nobody to actually... There's no nurses to... There's no nurses rostered to run the list, so like it's not actually possible.
I heard most of that over the gentle sound of crunching eggshells.
Oh, what was crunching?
No, I'm joking. You happen to speak so carefully. I'm only joking.
Oh, I was going to say. So, yeah, okay, so I get you. Sorry, I missed the analogy.
Sorry, that's my fault. Yeah, I know it is more complex, and I think it's been a fantastic insight into the complexity of it because you know a headline just says one thing. It doesn't tell the whole story. And it's like everything. We need to look at it in all grades and see where we need more people, you know, because next thing you know, if you had the wrong person in the wrong job and there's a problem, that becomes the big story then. So it's so important, Louise, that it's looked at right across the spectrum of employees there.
Yeah. I get that the Minister for Health has put a huge amount of money into getting this contract across the line and she wants some return from this huge investment into the HSE. I get that. And I also see that she has said in 10 years' time we'll be there and we have to start somewhere. And that's exactly what she's doing. And I suppose all this noise from both sides is kind of pointing out, like, she's like, come on, let's get going. Yeah. And we're saying, hang on, provide us with the rest of, you know, to provide us with the skeleton to work within and we will help deliver.
Yeah.
So it will be a bit of push and pull. Like, I use the health service as a patient the same as you do and anybody else. I'd like to think, God, I'd actually like to go to an appointment on a Saturday because it would be easier and then I don't have to miss a day of work. Or, you know, I'd like it, the whole thing to be more efficient. But they have to provide that you cannot have resources for 5 days and suddenly say
spread
it's six.
Them to six.
And where do you fill in the gaps?
And anyone in any building listening to this in any workspace will understand exactly what we're talking about. They could ask me to do a Saturday, but unless there's the people that are there that makes it happen, you couldn't do it. Louise, always a pleasure to have you on the show. You explain things so easily that I can follow, which is great. Appreciate your time. Dr. Louise Moran, consultant anaesthetist at Letterkenny University Hospital. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.